Alaska Public Media's Every Little Bit recognizes people who go above and beyond to strengthen our community in Anchorage and South Central Alaska.
I think if someone wants to start a community event, they should just go for it.
I believe in serving your neighbor, love one another.
There's always something that you can do.
Wherever people meet one another's needs, all of us are enriched by that.
Do you know someone doing good in your community? Nominate them at alaskapublic.org/littlebit.
Oh, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews, a licensed therapist and a professor of psychology at Alaska Pacific University. Today, we're talking about something that doesn't get nearly enough attention. And a note to listeners, on this show, we will be talking frankly about suicide. Many people assume suicide rates peak during the darkest months of winter, but research consistently shows something different. In many places, including Alaska, we lose more people to suicide in the spring and early summer. Here in Alaska, that seasonal shift is especially powerful. We go from months of darkness into rapidly increasing daylight. Snow melts, roads soften, rivers break up. The pace of life changes almost overnight. We call it breakup for a reason. It's messy, unpredictable, and intense. For some people, that seasonal shift brings energy and relief. For others, it brings agitation, insomnia, anxiety, mood swings, and in some cases, increased suicidal thoughts. Today, my guests and I will explore why that seasonal transition can increase vulnerability. We'll talk about how depression, anxiety, and mania may intensify and what Alaskans should look out for. I want to introduce our guests today. We have two incredible guests joining us to help us unpack this important topic. Dr. Diane Droutman, Associate Professor of Nursing at Alaska Pacific University, and Dr. Mary Beth Goodman, Director of Stephen A. Cohen Military and Family Clinic at Alaska Behavioral Health. Diane, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Diane, and I am a professor at Alaska Pacific University. I primarily teach mental health there, and I've been in Alaska since 2019.
All right. And Mary Beth, Dr. Mary Beth Goodman, would you tell us about yourself?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on today. My name is Mary Beth Goodman, and I run the programs for Alaska Behavioral Health that deal with service members, families, and veterans and their mental health needs throughout the entire state of Alaska. I've been doing this work for about 27 years now and came to Alaska about 6 years ago to start the programs.
Well, welcome, guests. Thank you. I am so grateful to have both of you here to help us navigate this really big issue. Let's start by getting to know a bit more about your backgrounds and the work you do for Alaskans. Mary Beth, can you share your professional journey and what led you to become a licensed professional counselor and later pursue your PhD?
I have to chuckle a little bit, and we were talking about this before we went live. Sometimes the smallest things start your journey, and it's a conversation. I actually graduated college with my degree in mathematics, physics, and education. And so I went and I was teaching high school. And I'll be very blunt, I could not help my children that I was teaching. They were individuals who just really struggled with so many mental health concerns or situational issues that I took a local class at one of the local colleges, absolutely fell in love with it. And that's what started my journey, was just not being able to impact the people who surrounded me on a daily basis. It has been a lifelong journey. I am privileged to be a veteran spouse, was a military spouse for 25 years before my husband retired. And that meant me to move every 2 to 3 years. And so during that time, I got to experience mental health in different areas of the country and in different needs. So everything from eating disorders to community-based mental health to partial hospitalization programs and inpatient mental health. And what that really taught me is that there is no area of mental health that every citizen does not need to access at some point. And so that's really kind of what led me to what I do today.
Wow, thank you. And Diane, would you share about your background in nursing and what led you into nursing education?
Well, I don't know why I became a nurse. It was just something that was almost like not a choice. I mean, it was something that I just liked working with people. And when I was a teenager, I used to go in on the weekends and visit my mom at work and talk to the patients. And I just really loved doing that. So I went to school, and the program I was in, we worked 3 months and we went to school 3 months. So it was a 5-year bachelor program. And many times I would work, during my years in school on mental health units. And I really enjoyed that because the main thing to do is really just to listen, you know, not to talk so much, but just to listen to what people have to say. And that's just always resonated with me. So after I graduated, I worked in mental health for about 5 or 6 years. I had a chance to, somebody asked me to come in and talk to their nursing students. And I did that, and it was just so much fun. So then I started working part-time as a clinical instructor. Liked it so much, I went and got my master's. I didn't feel I got much on education and a master's in nursing. It was before we had like master's in nursing education. So I also did a master's in education and learned so much and just really enjoyed working with the students and figuring out some of the things that they needed. So I developed a study skills program because that's one of the hardest things people have is how do you study? And from there, I thought, well, you know, if I'm going to get better at what I'm doing, so I went back and got my PhD.
All right. Thank you for that. Mary Beth, as director of the Stephen A. Cohen Military Family Clinic, who do you see?
The definition of, you know, clients within the military community is so broad. One of the things I'm going to do a lot today is actually define things. It's who I am. Words matter. We talk a lot in our population about SMVF, service members, families, and veterans. And that's the population that we see in the specific clinics that AKBH offers around this. And that really is anyone who serves active duty, but that can also be reserves. That can be guard members. That can be individuals who are veterans, meaning they wore the uniform for one day. Obviously, their families, biological, genetic, you know, that's an easy definition. But more so, we in the military community, the SMVF community, identify family much broader. For instance, there might be an auntie or a tia who has come up to take care of a family that is both mom, dad, military. We call them dual couples. And they bring up a family member who comes into their home and is their child caregiver. But that person might not have traditional insurance. That person might not have the things that people need to get mental health needs met here in Alaska. And so we see them. We define them as family, and they would be welcome in our clinics. We really try to make that the broadest definition possible. The other population that you might not know of is think about all of those people who serve those who serve, those first responders who are responding to military members on base. They are traversing the gates almost daily to help those forces blend together. And so most of our first responders here in Alaska are one step away from the military. They just don't realize it yet. And so we do a lot of education in those communities as well, that their needs need to be taken care of because they have such a stressful job as well.
Thank you. What mental health challenges are most common among military members and their families here in Alaska?
You know, one of the most common things we see is adjustment to change, just a very simple in clinical terms, an adjustment disorder with mixed anxiety and depression, or, right? But it really is adjusting to who we are in Alaska and the lifestyle. And that might be altered daylight, that might be altered climate, that might be driving on roads, that might be really struggling with what do I even wear? I'm sorry, I'm sending my children to school and they have recess until negative 10. You know, for someone who grew up in Florida or Puerto Rico or California, that is such a foreign concept. And so some of the things that we really do see is that adjustment, and what comes along with that is higher levels of anxiety, higher levels of self-doubt, higher levels of seasonal depression.
Thank you. And Diane, can you tell us a little bit about suicide prevention education in nursing curriculum? Many listeners may wonder, what does my nurse know about mental health? What does my nurse know about what I'm experiencing emotionally rather than physically?
So we do talk to, I do talk to them about the mental health continuum, where everybody's somewhere on that line of mental health to mental illness. And little things can make you go up and down. So kind of checking with themselves on where they might be at and, you know, the coping skills that can be used. And as far as talking about suicide, we talk about what we need to look for, some of the things that make somebody more vulnerable, some of the protective factors. But I think the biggest thing is it's okay to talk about it. The biggest problem I think we have is nobody wants to ask and nobody wants to really look into it. You know, the thought of if I ask somebody if they have thoughts of hurting themselves or if, you know, they have thoughts that they want to die, if, you know, I don't want to ask them about it because if they're not thinking about it, I could make them think about it. And that's not the case. I think one of the things is since we don't talk about it, it becomes this quiet thing. And really, it's so prevalent. And most of the time, people just need to talk. They need a connection. So if we could help people understand that and that it's okay to talk. And if you're worried about somebody, just ask them.
Wow. Sounds like you're normalizing talking about suicide with the nursing students. Mary Beth.
I just really want to echo exactly what my colleague is saying next to me. We actually do something in our therapy practice where we actually make people practice back and forth. Are you thinking about suicide today? And the reason for that is normalizing, destigmatization. But I always like to go back to what we as women have done for breast cancer. 20 years ago, I couldn't have said that on public radio. Everyone would have shut my mic down and shushed me. Wouldn't it be lovely if 2 minutes from now, no one has any issue with the word suicide? It is not a dirty word. It is not a shameful word. It is a symptom. It is a medical incident that occurs. Mental health is physical health, and that is what we do here. We take care of the whole body, and it's so important to integrate nursing and therapists and physical therapists and podiatrists and family practitioners and our whole community, because the reality is suicide is not a dirty word, and you have to be willing to ask people, because I'm telling you right now, everyone has thought about it. It has been a fleeting thought in someone's mind throughout the course of their life, and they're waiting for someone to actually want to have a meaningful conversation and connect so that they can be seen, heard, and valued.
Thank you. Excellent. It sounds like there is a lot of commonality in that normalization. Mary Beth, how do you feel seasonal transition affects veterans and active duty families? Do you think it's different from the general population?
You know, I think in many ways, the SMVF population and the general population are so similar. We really do have the same neuro connections and the same brain chemistry. It transcends race, religion, socioeconomic. It's there. More specifically, as we transfer from the darkness to the light through breakup, you described that so beautifully. We see that sometimes our mood actually lifts a little bit. We have a little bit more vitamin D intake. We have a little bit more hope. We have a little bit more energy. And so individuals who only needed that little bit of energy to really take action on a plan that had already been there, that's when it becomes so dangerous. When you lay over the SMVF population, we move seasonally. Our population, about every 2 to 5 years, average of 3.5 years, but typically this is the time of year where we're gearing up towards a major move. We're looking for, it's called PCS season, permanent change of station. And so families are getting ready to change schools, new driver's license, new homes, everything. But what happens is that our body cycles still think that we're on that 2, 3, 4 year move cycle. And so the other thing that kind of lays over that breakup and that increased hope and that increased activity is that need to change. And if there's not a change coming, or maybe if there is a change coming, that can throw just a little bit more amplification of those symptoms. The other thing that we really need to talk about here with this seasonal spike in suicide numbers is having these conversations in early March, having these conversations when we have realized, I'm sorry, why have you been in your basement for a full month? Like, I'm so grateful that video games exist. They're lovely. They're wonderful. But how about we get out of the basement and take a shower? How about we move through? And sometimes we lose people. And I'm not sure if that happens within the college community, but I know it happens sometime in the military community where these individuals are just, it's cold, it's dark, no one's going outside, so we lose touch. Those are the times to have the conversations and draw people out and make sure they know that they're seen by others.
All right. Diane, did you have something to add?
You know, I was talking to some elders about what they would do in the villages when they were growing up, because this is not, you know, depression is not something new. And they said if they noticed somebody was like staying to themselves and not really getting out, especially during these months, they would actually go and get that person. And it wasn't, he's like, they were like, it doesn't, it's not like I say, okay, you go this day, you go this day. It was like, looking around, he's not here, I'm going to go get him. And they pull him out, and because it's the socializing, that lack of connection that happens during the winter that causes people to feel more isolated and a little more depressed. So I think getting those connections, and then again, the energy level. When somebody is thinking about suicide and they're depressed, they don't have the energy to really do anything with that. So it's one of the things with the change of season, and we get some energy in the spring. Also, if they start on medications, after they've been on medications for about a month or two, they start getting more energy. And that is the time that they are at a dangerous spot, because now they have the energy to carry out what they've been thinking about.
Well, thank you very much. As an instructor at APU, Alaska Pacific University, do you notice or see mental health concerns amongst students intensify in spring and summer?
Well, I think it intensifies more at the mid to almost end of the semester. They tend to get a little more anxious as, you know, finals and everything are coming up. So I see more at that time. And, you know, I'm not sure about if it's the spring that comes into it. But again, they're getting ready to, you know, finish that course. And then they're going to be moving right on to another. Nursing school is very fast paced. They get so much information in a short period of time. And sometimes it's when they remember, oh, I'm going to be the nurse. Like, I can't, there's nobody there to ask because I'm going to be the nurse. And we remind them that there's always nurses around to ask questions. But I think, again, that change time, yeah. You know, some change is coming.
Yeah. So it sounds like for listeners who may have college-aged family members that springtime and towards the end of semesters is a good time to connect with them.
Yes.
All right. Well, we are, we've laid the groundwork by understanding the professional lenses each of you bring to the issue. When we return, we're going to dig deeper into what's actually happening in the brain and body during Alaska's dramatic shift from darkness to extended daylight, and why that biological change can increase vulnerability for some people.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, on Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Before the break, we got to know our guests and their professional backgrounds. Now we're going to dig a little bit deeper into the science and clinical realities behind these patterns. What happens when circadian rhythms, our sleep rhythms, shift rapidly? How does sleep disruption impact trauma, anxiety, or depression? And why can increase energy actually increase thoughts of suicide instead of decreasing them? Mary Beth, what changes do you observe in clients as daylight rapidly increases in the spring?
Sure. I think it's important for us as we're talking to the audience out there that as we say some of these things, if you yourself are understanding like, oh my goodness, this is something I'm experiencing, please refer back to all of the help numbers that you've been given. But some of the common symptoms that we see as therapists are sleep disturbance, number one, right? It's time to... You want the windows open all day, but you got to remember to shut those curtains at night again because that daylight expands. Increased agitation, maybe your frustration tolerance lowers and you're just a little bit more snappy. Some irritability, anxiety spikes. You might see like mood swings. You know, one minute you're okay, but the next minute you're just a little bit more on edge.
Well, one of the things that we kind of want to know more about is circadian rhythm. So from a body point of view, what happens in the body when circadian rhythms are disrupted by light changes?
Well, the circadian rhythm helps us, you know, be tired, to fall asleep. Our body produces melatonin so that it helps us sleep at night. And when the light is increased, that the melatonin doesn't start to be produced. But the other thing that we need to think about is that stress and anxiety also changes how we feel physiologically. When we have stress or depression, that's when people get sick. And they say, you know, and breakup time is a time when we tend to all get sick. And the change in our bodies and what they're going through and the anxiety that we can feel during this time actually causes the body to have less of an immune response. So we're more susceptible to get sick when we're stressed or we're anxious. And that is one of the bigger problems. And we need to be able to figure out what we can do to help calm ourselves and do some of like different coping techniques, such as, you know, taking a step back from what's going on and, you know, reading a book, taking a walk outside. Now that it's getting warmer, that exercise really helps. And it actually, when you do some of these coping techniques, it actually releases some of those happy endorphins that actually make you feel better. But that also helps your body get that stress reduced so that the immune response works better and you're less likely to get sick.
Mary Beth, what maybe physical symptoms might start to worsen, like worsening anxiety or depression and the physical symptoms that are associated with those? What might that look like for listeners so that they can know, hey, I need to pay attention here?
Sure. It might be as simple as an upset stomach. It might be as simple as your appetite either increases or decreases that's not necessarily proportionate to the activity level. You might find yourself having headaches. You might find yourself being exhausted. You know, I just slept 8 hours. Why am I exhausted? Why am I waking up with a headache? Those are the things that are really kind of easy to identify, and some of the things that are not as easy as the chronic sickness. You know, this is, as my colleague pointed out, this is breakup season. And when breakup season happens, everything is released to include pollens and molds and all that good stuff, or bad stuff. But so it might be, oh, you know what? I really have been sick for 4 months in a row. What's really going on? Do I need to talk with my primary care doctor? Do I need to figure out how to manage my stress? One of the things that happens this time of year is we put so much pressure on ourselves because, let's face it, it's Alaska. A pipe broke in January that we put a patch on, but now it needs to be fixed. And I just shoved all the Christmas stuff in the garage or the holiday decorations from Thanksgiving in the garage because I didn't want to go out to the shed to put it away. And the end of the semester is coming. And so those of you with families are doing studies and tests and more parent projects. So as we walk into spring, we already have a laundry list of things that need to happen that's at least a mile long. And every day we add more to that list without taking off, our stress increases, even if we're not conscious of it. And so that, coupled with some of those physical symptoms we talked about, it's really important to understand, wait a minute, is this really just seasonal allergies? Is this really just a minor cold? Or have I been down for multiple weeks now?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a call. Tom, what's your question?
Hi, were you asking for Bob?
Bob, sorry, Bob.
Yeah, no problem. I'm just checking to make sure I don't jump the line. We had a public health nurse training in Tok, Alaska in the early 1970s. And the presenter was mainly talking about alcoholism as befits warning village folk. But she said that exactly what you said in the introduction, namely that this time of year is the worst for incidents and suicide attempts and so forth. But she went beyond that. And so it's nice to know that's validated by current statistics. But she went beyond that to say that's probably because people realize that the long nights and the cold temperatures of winter were really not the cause of their problems. And now it was spring and they realized they needed to own them, so they do themselves in. Is that purely speculative or anecdotal, or is there any support for that in the research?
Thank you so much for that question. This is Mary Beth answering. There is research that indicates that, and we all know that our struggles, our own internal, the baggage that we carry goes with us no matter what season it's in. And so let's take a disease like alcoholism or drug addiction, and perhaps it amps up in those cold winter nights when we're isolated. And then all of a sudden, something that was a recreational use is now a habit, is now a daily addiction. But it also caused maybe some marital problems, maybe some family systems where the kids don't want to chat anymore. Maybe they're afraid of the individual in the house who was having that accelerated use. Maybe it exacerbated and there was no job over the winter because of seasonal work here in Alaska. And so all of those problems that really just started to build and build and build, and now that things are looking like they should be brighter, all of a sudden, it's not on a dime that we can turn around and say everything's magical, it's spring. And so there is some truth to that. There's some wonderful studies that have been done by the National Institute of Health that confirm that. But I think it's more than that. I think our problems will never just magically disappear. You know, all of us in this room are mental health providers. And one of the things I wish I had graduated with was a magic wand to help every single client at every single time to make everything better. But the reality is I was not put here to rescue. I was put here to empower and to offer skills to my clients. And so sometimes that bridge of, I need magic, I haven't done all the work yet, that bridge is so great that if you're not working with people who can help bridge that gap, suicidal thoughts and actions occur.
Thank you so much, Bob, for your question. Diane, what role does increased energy and maybe even feeling decreased energy in the spring, how might that impact overall mood?
Well, when they have the increase in energy, they're more likely to carry out something they've been thinking about, because before they didn't have that energy level that they wanted to like get off the couch and do anything. So that is part of the problem. And then if they don't have ways that they can like talk it out or figure out what they need to do to get themselves back on track. And I think one of the hardest things people have is asking for help. It is so hard to ask for help. Mm-hmm. And with, you know, how our society's changed, we're not as social. Everything is online. Mm-hmm. We don't have that personal contact. And I feel that sometimes it's even harder to reach out when it's not somebody you know. And, you know, friends online are great, but when somebody is going through something like this, they need somebody with them. They need more of that personal contact, somebody to actually be able to see and talk to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. You mentioned something about that outreach. And I think so many of our listeners today are really general public who are just really interested in mental health. And thank you for that interest. Once upon a time, none of us knew how to do CPR. We really didn't know how to do basic first aid. And so as part of that stigma reduction in those health campaigns, you know, all of these CPR classes popped up. Individuals took them to even do babysitting in major cities. There are mental health courses, mental health first aid, assist training, QPR. These are all courses that exist to help our citizens, to help people who just have a passion to help their fellow neighbor or to help the mental health community, to really give them a skill set to be able to kind of start those initial conversations and then transition to a healthcare provider that can actually help, if whether it's medication management or a specific evidence-based therapy. But there's so much out there that our population that's listening to might be interested in.
Yes, and we use QPR at the college, and it really helps them understand that it's okay to talk about it, but gives them ideas on some of the questions they can ask. And I think, you know, having that chance to know that it's okay to talk about it, and these are some questions that might help, I think if we can get more of that to the general public, I think that would be great.
Mm-hmm. When we hear the word mood disorder, many people, when we hear mood, we think of mood disorder, and many people may not know what a mixed mood state is or what entails a mood disorder. Mary Beth, would you share with us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, to start with, those of us in the helping profession for mental health are familiar with a great big book called the DSM. It's been through many reiterations, but the DSM is kind of our lifeline to diagnose. And so there's just hundreds of diagnoses in this book. And so as you go through your training, you're going to learn the very clinical names for these mental health illnesses. But when I talk to the public and I talk about things like a chronic mood disorder or a chronic mental health illness, what I really talk about is there is something going on in your body and in your brain chemistry that is manifesting a different level of hormones, of norepinephrine, of serotonin, of dopamine, of adrenaline, of cortisol. And these are real things that are producing or not being produced at levels that can create a typical life experience. I joke with people, I've looked in a mirror every day for well over 50 years and I've never seen a normal person, ha ha, but there's a typical life experience out there. And we can expect to have typical moods to where we are not crying one moment and then on cloud seven the next. So when we talk about these, for instance, bipolar has almost become an adjective in social media, and honestly, very negatively, right? We call that person, a diagnosis because they might be erratic in that moment. But when it becomes something that we're really concerned about from a biophysical mental health level is when, let's say they're so depressed that they don't leave their home for a week. They're not eating. They're not caring for themselves. Their activities of daily living, like showering and hygiene, maybe taking care of a pet or their children, is just not present anymore. And then maybe a month later, you're noticing that you're getting text messages from this friend who's so excited because they just cleaned out four of their closets, had three different job interviews this week, and they don't need sleep, and they finally feel better. That dichotomy, that polarization of being the lowest of the low and the highest of the high, that's when we really get into clinical terms like clinical depression, mania. And so when we're seeing things like that, that is a really good indicator to not only have a conversation, but to recommend somebody getting to see a therapist or their primary care doctor, or get in to talk to someone and not dumb those moods down or lower those, because those are things that are not a typical response. And those are things that we really can help with.
And how might seasonal transition breakup with its ups and downs impact someone with bipolar?
That is such a great question. Individuals who do struggle with any mental health disorder, including bipolar disorder, get lots and lots of education. Nurses like my colleague here are part of that amazing education, because the more you know about something that you call your own, the more you have control over it, the more you have power over it, and the more you are empowered. And so if that is something that you struggle with, you know that this time of year may exacerbate those conditions. So you may have a trusted friend who's saying, I've noticed you've had more up days than down. You might actually create a journal that your therapist or your psychologist is helping you create, where you're just rating your symptoms on a scale of 1 to 5. For someone who has diabetes, they are constantly in touch with their blood sugar levels, their nutritional, their exercise regimes. And it's something that while they are living with, they are living over, right? It is something that they want to strive over. It's the same with these chronic long-term mental health illnesses. We want our clients to make sure that they're aware, but that they're in control and they can really take these daily inventories. And so if they see that, oh my goodness, it was a gorgeous week. We were at negative 20 last week, but next week we're going to be in the 40s. We're going to start seeing some grass pop up. It's time to start our greenhouses going. That we're actually looking at, is this a typical mood response or is this an exacerbated mood response that maybe I just need to start tracking on?
Yes. And how might someone listening help someone that may experience symptoms of mania, you know, that elevated, expanded mood, or depression? How may they help?
Sure. One of my favorite lines, and if you've known me for any amount of time, you've heard it. Your listeners have probably heard it 3 times already. Know, see, and value. Right. It is very simple. If this is just a neighbor, do you know them? Do you know their routines? Do you know that they typically go out 5 or 6 times a week and now they're not? Are you seeing them? Are you giving a wave across the way? One of the fabulous assistants today brought us a cup of Earl Grey tea because she knew that that was something we might need. I felt so seen and valued. Those are the 3 things we can do all the time for friends, for our community members, for the people we work with. And when you do that, you've created a basic level of trust that I can turn to my colleague and say, Diane, every morning you have a cup of tea. And I really enjoy that. You know, we chit-chat a little bit. But for the last 3 days, you haven't come into the break room. I miss you. What's that about? And it's not accusatory. It's just very direct. But you've laid the groundwork to have those conversations.
Thank you. We're taking a final break.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Joining us today are Diane Droughtman and Mary Beth Goodman. Alaska's seasonal transitions are fast and dramatic. Structure disappears for many students. Military families navigate relocations and reintegration. People are expected to be more social. People may be able to be outside more. And for some people, that rapid environmental change increases emotional instability, which can lead to an increase in feelings of sadness or anxiety when everyone else may be feeling excited. We're going to talk about some things that might contribute to spring sadness or summer anxiety. Mary Beth, are Alaskans who may be in crisis, do they seem to be reaching out during spring and early summer?
Sure. You know, one of the things that's so important in healthcare in general is immediate access at the point of question. And I like the phrase at the point of question, not at the point of crisis. Typically, people do not reach out until there is a pain point. They don't reach out when there's just a, oh, this isn't meh, It's when it's, oh my goodness, I need help now. And so what we find in the spring and early summer is those crisis, those urgency appointments that, hey, can you get me in? And so we see a rise of that in the mental health community. And we really want to be able to access that. We really want to be able to give those clients the immediate access to services so that they're not waiting and it's getting worse. I think the waiting is why the crises happen versus when we can actually have impact at that point of urgency or point of concern.
Mm-hmm. And Diane, when we think about students, we have students who are in early education and middle school and high school and even into college. Are students, how does the loss of routine maybe during summer break impact students?
Well, they lose the structure of the daily routine and have to figure out how to do some things on their own. And I think that sometimes can be a problem. Knowing what you're going to be doing and having that structure is definitely better for people than that open flexibility where you have time to do, you know, different things.
Mm-hmm. And how may listeners who have children in, you know, early education, middle school, high school, and college help during those unstructured summer breaks?
I think helping them make a plan on what they're going to be doing over the break is important, and having some sort of routine so that, you know, keeping lunch every day at 12 instead of lunches whenever we feel like doing it. Just those little things can really help provide a little bit more structure.
Mm-hmm. And what advice would you give to a student who's listening if they're feeling overwhelmed right now?
They should reach out and let somebody know, their instructor, their teacher, parents. Sometimes it's a religious leader. Sometimes it's a neighbor that you just know a little bit better. And if you don't feel there's somebody right there, there are, you know, the 1-800 numbers that somebody is there and they're more than happy to talk to you and help give you some direction on where you can go to get more help. I think the other problem that we have is somebody who is having issues with a chronic condition like depression, being on medications, they look at it differently. And sometimes I don't quite get this, because if I have high blood pressure, I know I need to do something about that. I take my blood pressure pill every day. If I have depression, there are, you know, the neurotransmitters, the serotonin, the dopamine, you know, in our brains are a little off. And so we're taking something to help with that. And the thought that taking a med for a mental health condition is different than a physical condition is, I don't know where that came from. Mm-hmm. And it really does cause some problems, because you think, oh, you know, I feel better, I don't need this. And then it goes, you know, it's a bad cycle, because then it just starts up again. You know, if we have high blood pressure, there's something that's causing that. If we have depression, there's something that's causing that. And so I think looking at it and remembering that, you know, mental health is not different from physical health, but also if your mental health is not where it needs to be, then you're going to start having more physical health problems. Mm-hmm. Because it's our brain that, you know, if it's not working right, it's not going to work right for the rest of our body either. So it can really have long-term consequences.
Thank you. And we're going to go to a caller, Michael, who has a question about spirituality. Michael, welcome and thank you for calling in. What is your question?
Well, I guess I have, I just want to bring something to the front here. I am a retired physician and surgeon, and I did a residency in Rochester, Minnesota, and I had the privilege of living with an old nurse, Nellie Brogan, Irish Catholic, who had handed instrument to the Mayo brothers. And of course, Ernest Hemingway was hospitalized at St. Mary's Hospital in the early 1960s, and her son had been his attendant, and all of the psychiatrists at the world-famous Mayo Clinic did everything that they knew. They gave him all the meds at the time. I'm sure there are more sophisticated meds right now. And they thought he was just fine. They discharged him. He committed suicide. And it was her opinion that it was a spiritual or religious problem. And she, of course, believed in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and maybe Jesus. So, and also at the Johns Hopkins University, there are, I know there's a rheumatologist named Joan Bathon who did some studies on spirituality and chronic illnesses. And it seems like people that are connected to God or to some sort of, I think they were talking about the Christian religion, have a better time with chronic illnesses. They deal with it. I mean, it's just no fun. And this somehow gets them through, and they smile more, they frown less, and they commit less suicide somehow, some way. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. I believe we've had a demise or a decrease in religious activity and beliefs in the last 50 years. We've had an increase in mental health problems. We've had an increase in suicide. I have someone in my family that has bipolar, and you know, I mean, I guess it's a brain chemical problem, and drugs can help, but at the same time, drugs, they got a high that's very cheap and it's fun, and why would they want to take drugs to change that? That's mm-hmm. the main problem.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much for your question and bringing up spirituality. We're going to have an opportunity for either Mary Beth or Diane to respond to that.
This is Diane. Two things I wanted to point out. When somebody is hospitalized and getting treatment and then they're released, that's also about the same time that they have that increased energy that gives them more thoughts to completing their plan for suicide. The other thing that I need to point out is we talk about medications, but when we're talking about mental health conditions, you can't do just the medication. You need to have therapy. You need to make sure that you're connecting yourself with other people. So somebody who is having issues with depression, they might need to see a therapist every week. They need to make a plan of how I'm going to go out once a week and meet with other people. What is my activity that's going to get me socializing? So mental health is not just about medications. When I brought up medications, I was really looking at a lot of people are afraid to take some of the medications. And I think we need to remember that medications go along with the treatment. But just like with blood pressure, if I have a blood pressure issue, I'm going to take the medication, but that doesn't mean I stop seeing my cardiologist who's going to help me make sure it stays in control. So we need to make sure we encompass lots of things into that treatment plan.
I also would love to comment on that dimension of spirituality as being something that is bigger than. One of the things that I talk to my clients about frequently is if you envision yourself standing on a table, and this is your life and this is your stage, and one leg is your work, right? You're like why you get out of bed every day. And that might be different for some people. Some people it's occupational, employment, volunteerism, whatever it is. One leg is your family. One leg is your social. And then one leg is your friendships and your external social. If any one of those legs were to fall out from under you, like let's say your physical health fell out, now you've got three legs and you can envision yourself. You're not dancing close to that leg, you're moving back. And so if two legs go out, you're very wobbly. Spirituality almost becomes a pedestal in the middle for those individuals who deeply embrace their spirituality, whatever that spirituality is for you. And so as healthcare providers, it's really important to ask those questions, because if someone doesn't have that or they feel an anger towards their spirituality, that might inflect some more questions. These are just great things to discuss and to not shy away from.
Thank you. And before we go to our next caller, Michael, would you share with us where you work?
Oh, I'm retired. I was a plastic and reconstructive hand and microvascular surgeon between 95 and 2017 or so.
Wow. Thank you so much. It spans a long career. And thank you so much for your comment.
Yeah, I might also mention I spent a long time in a burn unit, and these people are hit with tremendous problems, and many of them lose their lives. And yeah, we had a psychiatrist, I guess, with the religious overtones that actually saw every patient in the burn unit at the burn center at Bothan Burn Center in San Francisco. And that seemed to really, he was great. I mean, he saw every person, whether they needed it or not, because they did need it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michael, thank you so much for bringing up spirituality. And just as Mary Beth said, it can be a third leg for you in that middle to be a pedestal. So thank you so much. We're going to go to our next caller. Emily has a question about therapy during the summer for children.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I really, really appreciate this topic today. I am a licensed therapist here in Anchorage, and one of the things that I notice in my career is that during the summertime, as school is ending, a lot of parents will just say, oh, well, we've got a whole bunch of things going for our children, so we're actually going to pause therapy, or, you know, we're doing okay, we're going to go ahead and pause therapy. And then inevitably come fall, when they come back, it's kind of more in a crisis mode where everything has just kind of imploded. There's no routine. The children are starting to act out again because they're now having to go back to school and things like that. And I was just kind of wondering, I love this topic of seasonal affective disorder being kind of switched up. And I was wondering if you guys could actually talk about that and the importance, like kind of just talking to the parents at large that might be listening about how important this is like you were saying, to keep the routine going, to also make sure to not break out one of those support legs that you were just talking about and take away things like therapy during the summertime.
Absolutely. Thank you for pointing that out. What I love to share with parents about is there's so much pressure on parents during the school year and really starting and meeting them where they're at. You're getting homework done. You're getting lunches done. You're making sure people are up. If your kiddo does sports, you're up at 4:30. You're not going to bed until 10. I had one parent tell me the other day, she's like, you know, it's almost like I'm behind the eight ball, but I don't even see the eight ball anymore. And so summer becomes a reprieve for parents. And so what I like to share with them is that, look, the summer becomes a reprieve. There's less commitments, but it's also an opportunity to continue to gain ground on those struggle issues that have been present. So if your kiddo is someone who might struggle with attention in the classroom, why don't we load on some skills during the summer when there's not all those pressures? So what we're actually doing is we're starting that kiddo out at a much higher level of skill retention than typically. And so almost pointing it out as this is a really great opportunity to gain ground. I also like to tell parents that structure is key, absolutely. But sometimes that looks different. So that might look like telehealth so that you can still have your vacations, but come back to the camper Mondays at 3 o'clock and we can still continue to meet. I really appreciate your point. Structure is so important to not lose in all health conditions.
I want to sincerely thank both of our guests for sharing their expertise and the important work they're doing for military families, students, and communities across Alaska. As we move into the brighter months, let's remember to check in on ourselves and each other. And if you or someone you know needs support, call or text 988 anytime. Our thanks to our guests, Dr. Diane Droutman, Dr. Mary Beth Goodman. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is a nationwide support line for anyone in crisis. Thanks to our audio engineer, Crystal Hyde, and our producer, Rachel Cassandra. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.